The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Civics 101, the podcast that teaches you things you should have learned or maybe forgot from your high school U.S. history and government classes. We thought the first 100 days of the Trump administration the perfect time for a little refresher. Each week, we'll answer one question, like how do vetoes work? What does a White House press secretary do? Or what is gerrymandering? Today, the role of the chief of staff, and Professor Charles Wolcott is our guide. He's professor emeritus of political science at Virginia Tech. For the past two decades, his research has focused on understanding the structural evolution and workings of the executive office. Professor Wolcott, welcome to Civics 101.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So there is nothing mandated in the Constitution for this position. When did White House Chief of Staff become a position?
It really became a position in the modern sense in the Eisenhower administration. The White House staff, or what's technically the White House office, was legally created in 1939 under FDR. But at that time, it had only about a half a dozen professional staffers, and it wasn't a big deal to manage it. In the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, all kinds of war reconstruction agencies were loaded into the White House because there was no place else organizationally to put them. And the White House suddenly grew to having a couple of hundred staffers. And it became a management problem. Harry Truman managed it by doing it himself, by having lots of people who could get access to him, and it worked out pretty well. But when Eisenhower took over, he was used to having someone on his staff as a general who would take care of running the organization while he made the consequential decisions. So he asked Sherman Adams of New Hampshire to move into the White House and become the first chief of staff, except that Ike didn't call him a chief of staff because he thought that would sound too military. He called him the assistant to the president. And that's when the chief of staff got started.
What is the role of the chief of staff?
The chief of staff organizes the rest of the White House. There are any number of White House offices, congressional liaison, counsel to the president. There are offices that deal with interest groups. There are policymaking offices. There's the press office, the communications office. All that stuff has to be coordinated and managed. And it's something that presidents simply don't have time to do. So the first thing a White House chief of staff does is select most of those personnel, or at least participate in selecting those people and managing them, supervising them, trying to make them work as a unit.
Well, selecting and managing, which probably also means firing.
Most presidents don't like firing people, and they often delegate that to the chief of staff. Yes, that's one of the jobs that's one of the downsides of the job.
So a little bit of an enforcer for the president, it sounds like.
Yes. Sherman Adams' nickname when he was serving Ike in the White House was the abominable no man. No, as in says no to people who want to see the president, who want to influence the president. He was protecting the president. And yes, that's been a positional requirement ever since. But the second most important thing, and I think in the coming Trump White House, maybe the most important thing, is structuring what's known as the staff system. It's a way of preparing decision issues for the president to decide. The idea is to draw in the comments, the recommendations, the opinions of everybody in the administration who might have an interest or some expertise in the issue or something at stake in the issue. Collect them, organize them, and get them to the president in a form that the president wants them. Most of them want these on paper. That means giving the president as much to work with as you possibly can.
What would you look for in a person to be an effective chief of staff? Clearly somebody who can play the role of the enforcer, someone who has some sense of discernment. What else?
the chief of staff has to be what's called an honest broker. If this central job of bringing in all the possible shades of opinion and points of view is to work, everybody else in the system has to be confident that the chief isn't spinning it, that the chief isn't working his own agenda, trying to dictate the outcome, trying to structure things so the president will choose X or Y. That's the only way you can have confidence that the system works. If the chief of staff is seen as somebody who will fairly and honestly represent all the shades of opinion, including those he doesn't agree with.
What would be the typical daily routine for a chief of staff?
Chief of staff would attend morning staff meetings. They're almost always early morning staff meetings of top presidential staff. At the end of the day and throughout the day is preparing paper to go to the president or is sitting in meetings with the president. In most administrations, the chief of staff or one of his deputies sits in on all important meetings with the president. Jim Baker, who's been chief of staff a couple of times, likes to talk about what he calls, oh, by the way, issues. When somebody's sitting there talking to the president, they're talking about an issue that the president understood would be discussed. They discuss it. Whoever it is, the secretary of a department or whoever it might be, gets up to leave and then turns to the president and says, oh, by the way, and then quickly requests something that the president is absolutely unprepared for.
Who reports to them?
Everybody else in the White House, except possibly the National Security Assistant. The National Security side kind of runs itself and is usually independent from the Chief of Staff's management operation. But everybody else, the counsel to the president, the press secretary, the communications director, all those people, as part of the White House organization, they report to the chief. Now, some people sometimes have walk-in privileges with the president and do not have to actually ask the chief for permission to see the president. But most people report to the chief, and they can't get to see the president unless the chief approves it.
So it sounds like there's a lot of power in this position. They're gatekeepers. They're enforcers. Can you give us an example of a chief of staff having any real specific or notable influence on policy or presidential decision-making?
One of my favorite stories is a story that Bob Haldeman, Nixon's first chief of staff, used to tell. Talking about protecting the president, this isn't a specific policy decision, but it's a sort of general thing chiefs of staff can do. Haldeman talked about at least one instance in which he would come in to the Oval Office and Nixon would be fuming because some senator had made a speech critical of the Vietnam policy of the administration. Nixon pounds the table and he says, "We want to put 24-hour surveillance on that bastard. Do it now. Go." And Haldeman, understanding that you can't run the government that way, would leave, forget about it for about 2 days. He's back in the Oval Office again. Nixon asks him, did you take care of the surveillance on that senator? And Haldeman would say, well, no. And Nixon would say, well, it's probably better that way. He had finally calmed down, and the chief of staff, by refusing to carry out the order, but not overtly refusing, just not doing it, had actually protected the president's interests. So there's that kind of influence that any good chief can have, sort of compensating for the president's foibles in whatever way is necessary. But otherwise, chiefs of staff have very important opportunities to influence presidents, and some of them try to and some of them don't. Some have policy specialties. Obama's first chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, was much more of an electoral politics and public policy type of guy who came in from Congress and had a lot of influence on, for example, the discussions around the health care plan. So it depends on the individual and depends on what the president wants.
How about in this incoming administration? So Steve Bannon was passed over for chief of staff. Rince Priebus named instead, former chair of the RNC. This is a man with considerable political experience in the game, so to speak. What are some precedents of how those two positions have worked together, the chief strategist and the chief of staff, that come to mind for you?
The first one that comes to mind is George W. Bush and Karl Rove. Rove was Bush's political strategist, political hitman in effect. And I think his role was somewhat similar to that that Bannon's going to play. And it was a much more prominent role in the White House than the chief of staff. Andy Card was George W. Bush's first chief of staff, who more or less remained in the background, made the trains run on time, and didn't get famous doing the job. I have a feeling that that's kind of the model, that Priebus is going to be the honest broker who tries very hard to regulate the system, discipline the president, make sure everything operates as it should. And Bannon is both a political strategist and I think an idea guy. He's going to be probably much more involved in policy than Priebus will be.
So, Professor Walcott, you know, we're trying to understand how the system works and how civics, for lack of a better word, works. Is there anything that for you, it's really important that people know about the chief of staff named by a president?
I think that there's going to be a controversy in the Trump administration, and probably people ought to understand what a chief of staff does, because Donald Trump has said he wants to run an organization that recalls what Jimmy Carter or Gerry Ford wanted. He wants a flat organization. He'll have a chief of staff, but he doesn't want a chief of staff who regulates the flow of information that closely or who keeps people away from him. This isn't going to work. It's going to turn out to be overwhelming. The president has way too much to do to also, on the side, discipline the White House. So there are going to be a learning curve here, and I think that Priebus will take on more and more importance as the Trump administration goes on and as Trump realizes he's going to have to lean on his chief for some discipline. At that point, I think, people ought to understand what the chief does. It's not that the chief tries to put the president in a bubble and wall him off from all inputs. It's that the chief tries to regulate and ensure that the president gets all inputs. And I actually think Donald Trump needs to figure that one out.
Professor Walcott, thank you for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Well, that does it for this week's civics lesson. Hope you got schooled and maybe took some notes. Next week, we will answer the question, what does the White House press secretary do? Civics 101 was produced this week by Logan Shannon with help from Maureen McMurray and Taylor Quimby.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When it comes to identity politics and issues where prejudice, ignorance, and misinformation cloud or prevent discussion, what is the best way to reach across the divide and find common ground? Twitter? Unlikely. How about a face-to-face discussion? In 2014, a study showing that a 20-minute conversation with a gay or lesbian canvasser could reduce homophobia and get opponents of gay marriage to switch sides was published to a lot of fanfare, proof that human interaction and dialogue could influence public opinion. Maybe you heard about it on This American Life.
And here's just how real and free-floating this conversation is. At one point, the voter feels comfortable enough to ask him,
At what point did you realize you were gay? I mean, how does a child realize they're gay?
I can think back to third grade, and I had a crush on a boy in the class. Some people think that being gay is a choice. I was talking with a voter, and he was telling me he thought it was a choice, and I said my choice was to accept being gay, and because I tried to be straight. And that just wasn't working.
Well, yeah, if it doesn't work, you know, it doesn't work.
And then at that point, the canvasser, Richard, very skillfully brings them back to the topic at hand.
So you have, your vote has a lot of influence on how my life goes. Oh, I'm with somebody now.
That's a lot to think about, too, because, you know, after meeting you, you're a hell of a nice guy. You know.
The study was later retracted after the author admitted to fabricating some of the results. It was kind of a big scandal. Now, a new study by the same researchers that debunked the first one may have succeeded in validating those early results, this time with the trans community. Josh Kalla is a PhD student from UC Berkeley and co-author of this new study called Durably Reducing Transphobia, a field experiment on door-to-door canvassing. Josh, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Virginia.
And the study tracks the work of David Fleischer, project director at the Leadership Lab, which organized the door-to-door canvassing featured on both studies. And David, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks, Virginia.
So, David, walk me through one of these interactions. You've just knocked on someone's door. Is there a script or training that you give to volunteers?
Yeah, there's extensive training because the single most important thing we do at the door, it's not what we tell the voter nearly so much as our building a rapport with them so that we can listen to what they have to say to us. And the conversation is most successful when we have voters be honest with us about their own prejudice.
So if you've just knocked on my door, what's the first thing you say?
Hi, Virginia. I'm Dave. I'm with the Leadership Lab, and we're talking to every registered voter in your neighborhood about an important issue. It's whether we're going to include transgender people in our non-discrimination laws. If you were going to make a decision about this, would you want to include transgender people in the non-discrimination laws or not include them in them?
Josh, you studied the results of those interactions, and what did you find? How effective is this method of interaction or intervention?
Yeah, we found that these types of door-to-door conversations were pretty incredibly effective at reducing transphobia, both in the short term and over a three-month period. We found that these interactions tended to reduce transphobia on the order of magnitude kind of comparable to how much homophobia decreased from 1998 to 2012.
Some of these canvassers are actually transgender, some were not. Was that a factor in reducing or measuring transphobia among those participants?
Yeah, I think one of the most important parts of the study was that we found that both transgender and non-transgender canvassers were similarly effective at reducing transphobia. There was really no difference between whether or not you are part of the trans community or you were just an ally going out to help.
David, you actually did some of this canvassing. We started the conversation. Ever find yourself getting into a debate or an argument with somebody who answered the door?
No, because our approach isn't to argue. We're really genuinely curious about what the voter has to say. And when we come to the conversation in a non-judgmental way and with some humility, what's impressive to me is that so many people really want to talk with us, even people who start out in opposition, in fact, are conflicted. And as we talk it through and they get to reflect on their real lived experience, either with transgender people or with their experience when they've been judged unfairly for who they are, they realize that they actually want to be less prejudiced against transgender people.
Have you ever heard from anyone who answered the door that they actually never met or spoken to somebody who is from the trans community?
Overwhelmingly, that's the case. More than 90% of the people we talk with have never met a transgender person, and a significant number have never really had a conversation with an LGBT person. Remember, Virginia, we're going to neighborhoods where we know most people are against us. So we could go to other neighborhoods where people are already on our side, and perhaps it'd be more common for people to know transgender people there.
So you're targeting conservative voting districts or zip codes?
That's exactly right.
That's David Fleischer. He is the project director of the Leadership Lab. I'm speaking with him and Josh Kalla. He's co-author of a study that found that a 10-minute conversation can have measurable effects in reducing transphobia. And those conversations come courtesy of David's group. So in a similar study, this was published in 2014, that made big waves, and an episode of This American Life that a lot of our listeners may have heard, but then later retracted. Now, this was after you and your co-author, another grad student, discovered that some of the data had been fabricated. How did that affect your process moving forward? Why did you decide to do it again?
Well, we had discovered the fabrication while planning this study on reducing transphobia. We had to dig into the original data in order to do something really banal, which was just figure out how big this experiment had to be, how many conversations Dave and his volunteers needed to have. And then the process of planning this experiment is when we discovered those irregularities. And the experiment was already set, and Dave and his team were committed to having these conversations and doing this experiment regardless of what we found.
Was there some sense that this could work differently?
Yeah, I think when we discovered the irregularities in the original study, that did not disprove the effectiveness of the conversations. It just meant we had no experimental evidence on whether or not the conversations were effective. But that lack of evidence doesn't mean negative evidence. Instead, what we had were the experiences of Dave and his team, and my co-author and I both also went canvassing with Dave and his team. So we really had these firsthand experiences that made it seem like there was something definitely happening at the doors and something worthwhile measuring.
David, given that for most people, going door to door is not an option to introduce themselves to somebody who thinks differently, how do you think that this lesson or these findings about empathy extend into other forms of communication? So social media, for example, or a family gathering?
Well, what I would suspect is that there's not a way to replicate this on social media, because you need to speak with people who disagree with you, and you need them to trust you. You need them to be honest. I don't know how you would be able to create that kind of an environment other than face-to-face. And then doing it with a family member at Thanksgiving is, I think, a possibility. And it would be really important that if somebody wanted to undertake that, there was some way in which they were doing this as part of a team, both so they could get training. And even though the conversation itself would be one-on-one, these are kind of scary conversations, and the stakes are even higher if you're talking to a family member than if you're talking with a stranger. So people would need to have a way to debrief with somebody afterwards, so they'd have support if they had a conversation that didn't change somebody's mind.
We're looking at a split of a public opinion anyway in polling in the United States, about 40% approval rating for incoming President Donald Trump, about 55% of people vehemently opposed. But without that training, without a team around you, how do you advise people to, you know, walk across that parking lot to someone with a different bumper sticker or something like that and have a dialogue? Is that a good idea?
Well, sure, it's a good idea. The biggest things to keep in mind are that you can get some training. There's going to be some training material online that we've just been lucky enough to create after I gave a TEDx talk that will go up in the next week or two. And the truth is, if you approach somebody with an attitude of real curiosity, you're going to get further than you might expect. And then finally, keep in mind that most people who polls show are strongly committed to one position or another, often that's a bit of an illusion. People are more complicated than that and are more conflicted than that. And once they know they can trust you to treat them decently and not judge, the possibility of having a good conversation is there. I grew up in Chillicothe, Ohio, a small town, and even when I was a boy, it was normal for neighbors to talk with each other about political disagreements. It's normal, actually, for one human being to talk with another human being and be affected by them.
Josh, how about for you? What's the next step after doing a study like this, finding these results, publishing them? Where do you go to now?
These results are incredibly promising. As Dave was saying, this is not new, having these types of face-to-face conversations. What is new is we just have evidence that these face-to-face conversations work. And I think the real next questions are, why do they work? Can we figure out some kind of broader principles from psychology and human interactions that can teach us something deep about how people talk and how people are persuaded. And then I think the next question is also, on what other issues can you effectively persuade someone? How can these types of conversations be applied more directly to issues of politics or racism or Islamophobia or whatever it may be?
Josh Kalla, co-author along with David Brookman of Durably Reducing Transphobia, a field experiment on door-to-door canvassing. Josh, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Virginia.
And David Fleischer is project director at the Leadership Lab, which did the canvassing. David, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's a real pleasure, Virginia. Thank you.
You can read more about the study and an article about David's work. It's from the New York Times. The links are at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When you think of a racetrack, you probably picture a smoothly paved oval with pit crew standing by and bleachers rising up on all sides. But at Utah's Bonneville Speedway, the world's fastest vehicles compete without stands or pavement, zooming across a desert of bone-white salt at hundreds of miles per hour. Racers have attempted to break land speed records at the Bonneville Salt Flat since 1914. Today, every imaginable form of vehicle gets tested out on those salt beds at annual events like the World of Speed and Speed Week. Well, we wanted to hear more about this amazing outdoor track, so we're joined now by Dennis Sullivan. He's president of the Utah Salt Flats Racing Association. And Dennis, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much.
So describe the flats for us. How do they look right now in winter?
In winter, they're completely covered with water. That's how the salt cures itself after its use and the cars going across it. So Mother Nature covers it with water. The water puts the salt in solution and smooths it out for us.
So they can't use it right now for racing, can they?
No. We have to wait until in the spring, and then we watch it to see as the water goes away. Then we start looking for tracks. And depending on what kind of a spring we have, it depends on how late in the year we can get on the salt to start looking for something.
So how much area are they? How big is the salt flats?
The salt flats are about 90,000 acres.
Wow. So what's it like to drive on salt? Is it different than on pavement?
Oh, yes. It's a lot different. It feels similar to being on the snow. It is slippery. If you step on the gas real fast, the tires will spin. You can turn real sharp and the car will slide. It's very much like being on snow, but then again, when it finally gets dry and hard, it can be as hard as concrete, but it still has a small granular surface on it that does give you a little bit of slickness.
Well, that to me sounds like you slow down. What makes it good for racing?
It is one of the flattest places on the earth, and when you're there, you can actually see the curvature of the earth. The expanse is so large that if something does happen, there's nothing to hit. You can't hit a wall or a pole or anything like that you would on a conventional asphalt-type track. The salt has a cooling effect on the tires, so when you get tires that are spinning up in excess of 400 miles an hour, you don't have the heat buildup. That's one of the things that's really important for cars that are traveling that fast and that distance.
So are you a racer yourself?
Yes, I am. I hold a national record.
What's your record?
I have a 1927 Model T with a 120 cubic inch four-cylinder engine that's naturally aspirated, and we hold the record at 143 miles an hour.
Wowie. Well, what are some of the other notable records that have been broken or made at the Salt Flats?
All of our vehicles are wheel-driven. There is a segment of cars that are thrust-powered, have jets and rockets, but we deal with mainly wheel-powered. The wheels actually have to move the car vehicle. The current wheel-driven record is 458 miles an hour, held by Don Vesco in a car called the Turbinator.
So, but all sorts of vehicles. I watch videos of bicycles racing, motorcycles racing. What are some of those records?
This last September, we had a wonderful lady named Denise Mueller that came out with a bicycle to try to become the world's fastest person with a bicycle. She ended up being the fastest lady on a bicycle, and so she's planning, I've been in contact with her, and she's planning on coming back this coming September to try to go for the fastest person on a bicycle, which will be exceeding 160 miles an hour.
Wow, 160 miles an hour. And I'm seeing her motorcycle, 367.382 miles an hour. My God. Do people get hurt doing this?
You know, racing is inherently a dangerous sport. And yes, people have been hurt and people have lost their lives. But everything we can do, we do to make things safety. People have to wear fire suits, helmets, neck and head restraints, arm restraints, so that if something does happen, their arms can't get out in the open. Every vehicle must have an onboard fire extinguisher. And depending on how fast you go, you have to carry more and more agent. Anything over 175 miles an hour has to have a parachute. Then when you get up to the next level, you have to have two parachutes. And if you go fast enough, you have to have three parachutes. We use special tires. We do everything we can. All the vehicles are safety inspected prior to ever being able to run to make sure that they are safe. They meet all the safety requirements, welds, tires, safety equipment. So, and unfortunately, most every rule that we have for safety was at one time written in blood because something happened to someone.
I'm speaking with Dennis Sullivan. He's president of the Utah Salt Flats Racing Association. And we're talking about the unique environment at the Bonneville Racetrack. That's where land and speed records have been set and broken for years, and cars, trucks, bicycles, motorcycles, all kinds of vehicles. How about damage to the environment?
You know, once, and we mark the course with a dye. It's the same dye that they use to detect leaks in drinking water systems, so it's safe dye. And then during the winter, when it's underwater, all of that stuff disappears and it's absorbed. So as far as the environment goes, there is no vegetation out there. There is no bugs out there. There is no animals out there. And when we leave, you can't tell we have ever been on the salt.
So some events have been canceled in recent years, and I read that it's because the salt crust has actually been thinning. What's going on?
What's happening is, we started racing in 1914. In 1917, because of the First World War, and the potash supply from Europe was cut off, they started mining for potash out in this area. Potash makes up less than 3% of the volume of minerals that are taken off the salt flats. And consequently, from prior studies and when John Campbell Captain Easton came over in the 30s and 40s. Tests were done because Bridgestone Tire Company was worried about it. We know that then the salt was anywhere from 11 inches to 18 inches thick. Another study was just done in September. The thickest salt they found was 2 inches thick, and the thinnest was a 16th of an inch. We're getting to the point that we do not have enough distance, and we don't have good enough salt to be safe. There was a time when we had 13 and 15 miles of racetrack. Now, if we get 7 or 8, we're excited.
Let me ask you, Dennis. So, given that there has been some degradation of the salt surface, do you fear for the future of the Bonneville Salt Flats as a racetrack?
Yes, we do. And it's not just the racers. There's so much more that goes on out there. Probably half of your car commercials are filmed out there. Movies like Independence Day, Pirates of the Caribbean, World's Fastest Indian, are all filmed out there. There's the Longbow Archery World Championships are held out there. Wedding photos, calendar photos. It's a unique place that people come and look at. And yes, we are fearful, but we do think that there is a solution to this. If we take this excess salt that's sitting on the south side and we're able to put it back on the north side, we feel that there is a future for the Bonneville Salt Flats, and we can continue to make it grow back to the way it was in the 60s and 70s, that we can get the salt back that we need to help us have cars. We have cars right now that are capable of 500 miles an hour, but we have no place for them to run.
Dennis Sullivan, president of the Utah Salt Flats Racing Association, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome, and I'm glad to give you any information I can about a place that we truly love, and we want to see people continue to be able to race on it and come and watch the racers for 100 years more.
Well, we will send people to our website for more information. That's wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Broke for Free, Ketza, and Delay. There's a lot more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We're also on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio and on Twitter at Word of Mouth. And we invite you to listen on your own time with the Word of Mouth podcast. Just search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or Google Play. And please rate the podcast, which will help other people find it, because everything just goes further when shared by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.